2007. Welcome, members. Welcome, folks here to testify on the bills before us today. Members, we have a full agenda for today, and I'm glad Representative Greenlick is here. Full of motivation in front of the committee. Our committee administrators did a wonderful job scheduling us through the bills that we have and are anticipating. We will be able to finish our work on time. There's a possibility that next Friday afternoon, which is the Friday before Memorial Day, Representative Greenlick will not be present, and that has inspired me to try to see if we can not meet on that Friday afternoon. So I'm using that as inspiration to try to get through our work.
I thought I would have gotten our administrator to add bills for Friday afternoon.
Yeah, we get through
that
stuff.
Especially if Cromwell wasn't here, too. You and Cromwell gone, that did inspire some. But I think what we're going to go ahead and do is we're going to jump around a little bit in the agenda today. I'm going to open a work session on one of the bills we carried over from last time, Senate Bill 1040. And Mr. Olson, if you would remind us what Senate Bill 1040 is all about, please.
Yes. Senate Bill 1040 requires that school district boards adopt policies and procedures relating to self-administration of medication by students with asthma or severe allergies, exempt certain school personnel from liability and criminal action, or for civil damages when assisting students to self-medicate under written permission from student's parent, guardian, or health care professional, declares an emergency effective July 1st. There's a Dash 3 amendment, which is identical to the Dash 2 that we saw before, except it deletes the word inhaled in the definition of medication, so that bronchodilators could be inhaled or other forms.
I thought it was going to be something like emergency bronchodilators.
In consultation with legislative counsel, when you get into emergency, it triggers other unintended consequences that could restrict the effectiveness of the bill. Apparently that was one of the views looked at previously, using the language emergency, and legislative counsel advised against it. And so the consensus was from the advocates to just delete the word inhaled.
Does it say prescribed bronchodilators in the bill?
The Dash 3 amendment says medication means any prescription for bronchodilators or auto-injectable epinephrine.
That's fine.
Members, we're in a work session. I'd accept a motion on the Dash 3s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1040.
Representative Dahlem has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1040. Is there discussion?
Sorry, I
That's
need to find it here a minute.
This amendment replaces the previous amendments.
Correct.
And includes the material in
Correct.
The previous amendment.
Right. Ma'am, you weren't here to talk about the amendment, where you want to talk about the bill itself? Okay. Are there any objections to the amendment? Hearing none, so amended. Could you please come join us and tell us your concern? And, George, did you want to come up as well to discuss this point? And I would appreciate, given the length of our agenda, a concise statement would be appreciated. And you can be kind enough to identify yourself.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Linda Alloway. I am a licensed respiratory care practitioner and a certified asthma educator. I bring to your attention a section of Senate Bill 1040, Section 1, 3C, that states, require that an Oregon licensed health care professional acting within the scope of the person's license formulate a written treatment plan for managing the student's asthma or severe allergy and for the use of medication by the student during school hours. I would like to bring to your attention a letter from Dr. Frederick Gill, who is a fellow of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, board certified by the American Board of Allergy and Immunology. He is the lead in the Kaiser Permanente Northwest Region Asthma Management Program. He is a member of the Kaiser Permanente National Asthma Guideline Committee. He is a member of the Physician Advisory Committee for the Oregon Asthma Program. He has reviewed Senate Bill 1040, and I'm quoting directly from his letter. I'm writing in support of making a change in the wording so that action plans for asthma at the schools are recommended rather than required. And then, as you can see in the letter, he goes into further detail why he justifies that. He supports the use of such written plans, but he thinks that health care providers are the most qualified to decide which children should have such a plan at school and should not be forced by law to provide one for all children with asthma. I secondly bring to your attention the National Asthma Education Prevention Program, Expert Panel Report, Guidelines for the Diagnosis and Management of Asthma, Update on Scheduled Topics, 2002. One of the issues is looking at written action plans compared to medical management alone and peak flow-based compared to symptom-based written action plans. Monitoring. The statement from this organization, which is part of the National Institute of Health and establishes the clinical practice guidelines for managing asthma in the United States, states, data are insufficient to support or refute the benefits of using written asthma action plans compared to medical management alone. In the final statement, they say, the NAEPP EPR2 recommendations have not been changed. It is the opinion of the expert panel that use of written action plans as part of an overall effort to educate patients in self-management is recommended, especially for patients with moderate or severe persistent asthma and patients with a history of severe exacerbations. I do not oppose the use of written action plans. I strongly encourage people to use them. But as Dr. Gill points out in his communication, some children do not require a written action plan for management of their asthma.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments?
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the American Lung Association of Oregon. Ms. Alloway just brought this to our attention. Our position has been that we've worked very hard on this bill, and we have consulted various people in the medical profession since we introduced this bill early on, and this was never brought to our attention. The Oregon Medical Association was consulted. Obviously, the school nurses have been here the whole time. The idea, the concept behind it was, we wanted doctors to be able to create some sort of action plan, some sort of written plan that would be able to give this to the schools. And that was sort of the intention, to sort of have that information. It's been sort of originally in the original concepts. It was always in there with the work groups. We think this is a good bill and would ask that you support it and move it forward.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
If I could make one other comment.
Very, very briefly, if you would.
Yes, it's very brief. I've been notified this morning that the Oregon Academy of Pediatrics supports this change in the wording as I request.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I think they're over-reading the words here. And I don't think we're talking about the treatment management program and trying to talk about a written action plan, which has a very specific meaning in terms of asthma self-help. I was involved in the very first research, as Linda knows, mm-hmm. on this. I think we're simply saying here that the school ought to have in their record a doctor saying what that patient ought to be doing. And I don't think they're talking about this concept of what do you do 24 hours, how do you deal with X and Y. I think it's simply the school. The words are a written treatment plan, and that simply means that I think they need on file that this patient has albuterol used this way when they get into this problem with something else. I think that's all we're talking about here. So I don't think we should overread this.
Representative Dolan?
As I read the bill, I had in mind the how to use the inhaler that comes right. when you go to the doctor. That simply would be, and it seems to me that comes with the inhaler or with the spacer or with whatever thing. I did not see the physician sitting down and writing a plan. I saw him providing information so that, and in my case, it was the school secretary, would have some notion that you hold the inhaler up this way and you shake it that way. And
no, that's not going to be enough.
Okay. That's what I read.
One more request, and I'm going to move on. Thank you.
Doctors currently provide a written prescription regarding medication use. What we're talking about in a written plan is about situations to avoid, when to take your other medications, all this other stuff. It goes beyond the school setting.
I don't believe we are talking about that in this bill. I know that's the common usage of what an asthma, a written action plan for asthma is. I don't think that's what this is.
Okay.
Okay. I appreciate you taking your time and bringing the thought forward to us.
Representative Rosa.
For the record, I agree with our good representative Greenlick in the sense that from my perspective and kind of what I'm a little bit in between. My issue, what I would like at the school basically, is the fact that there was a prescription written.
Yes.
And on it, it says that it can be used in case of,
yes,
you know, XYZ. Then I know that that's what this person's supposed to have in it. But to me, that's what this is. It's just a statement from the doctor that says, use this when he's having asthma problems. The student knows how to use it, and this EpiPen, the student knows when to give it to themselves. It's theirs. That's separate from just the directions on it, because my hope is they've already read the directions. They've already practiced the stuff, but we need to have authorization that this kid's supposed to have it, and he's got it. And
You're talking about a prescription. I certainly
basically
support
that's
that.
What I
that
say.
Has to happen. It is in place. What I'm talking about
I
is
understand.
The,
I understand
the other
document.
One, too.
Yeah, I do understand the other one. It has a specific name. This is not using exactly the same name.
Mm-hmm.
It uses part of it, but it doesn't use the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And from
thank
that perspective, I think it's
just written.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming forward. Thank you for your time. Representative Dolly.
In my mind, we've clarified that for the record. So I want to move the bill.
Motion, yes.
I move Senate Bill 1040 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dahl has moved Senate Bill 1040 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion?
And what was the amendment since I was late?
The amendment is the dash 3 amendment, Representative Lim. Dash 3, which
everybody agrees.
It takes out. If he doesn't mute, that's fine. Very good.
Well, that's what we're certified.
Is there any further discussion on the bill?
Oh, yeah.
Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll? Excused.
Aye.
Excuse. Oh, no.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion carries. Representative Greenlick, would you be so kind as to carry this bill to the House floor for us? We do have the amendment, Representative Dolan, for Senate Bill 392, so I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session for Senate Bill 392A. Thank you for your patience and my jumping around, members. And Mr. Olson, if you would, when you get a chance to grab 392A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 392A lowers the minimum age for required school attendance to 6, directs the State Board of Education to adopt rules ensuring that a child beginning public school for the first time be placed in a grade level appropriate to the child's cognitive development, applies at the beginning of the 2008-2009 school year. There are 3 amendments for the committee. 2 were discussed in the subcommittee. The subcommittee sent this bill to the full without recommendation because there were still amendments being discussed. The A2 amendment clarifies the language regarding being placed once the child is first placed in school. It deletes the word cognitive and said be placed in consultation with the child's parent or guardian in a grade level that is appropriate for the child's development. It does not change the mandatory minimum age of 6 as it would be in 392A. The A3 amendment, which we discussed also in the subcommittee, is regarding children who require the children once they attend school would be not be allowed to withdraw and would be allowed to continue at a child of age 5 or 6. The dash 3 amendment, which just came to us from legislative council because of the crush of other amendments they're working on, is before you. I'm sorry, the dash 4 has what I understand is an opt-out clause, and if the key part is on the bottom of page 2, it says, quote, the board by rule, referring to the Board of Education, the board by rule shall establish procedures whereby an exemption from compulsory attendance may be granted to the parent or legal guardian of any child who is 6 years of age. My understanding for talking to legal counsel is that would be from 6 to 7, and then at 7 there would be no exemption, so it would... the dash 4, if it was adopted, the new minimum age would be 6, but there would be this opt-out clause up to age 7. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
May I ask a question, please, Mr. Olson?
Representative Greenleaf.
All the other stuff is in the current ORS 339030.
Yes. I will double-check. I haven't yet, since we just got this, I haven't yet reviewed it, but I believe it is the only new part is the end.
It looks like the same. It looks like all what I have used before, so I agree that I think that's true.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion on the various amendments we have before us?
I'm also trying to dig this up. Is it true that let's see if I can find it, that 339030 isn't amended in the current bill? Is that also true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, the current bill does not amend 339030,
okay,
I believe.
Thank you, sir.
I believe, yeah,
I
let me
it
pull
now.
This out.
Yeah, I think it doesn't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, this is the section, 339030 is this... part of the section where the Representative Cannon was looking at part of this a little further on, was talking about the exemption for age 16 or 17 or working, and my understanding from Legislative Council is this section 3 and the dash A4 amendments are drafted along the same lines of those.
It's the exceptions for compulsory.
What did you
attendance.
Say?
That's the section of the law that is the exceptions from compulsory attendance
and this
currently
one.
In existence. And it adds it to that compulsory attendance law section as opposed to the law.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you very much, Doug.
Members, from our piecing together of this, it seems to me that the dash 2 and dash 4 would go together. The dash 2 being one that would ensure family participation and placement, and the dash 4 same forth a procedure for an opt-out. If there is comfort, I would entertain a motion on the dash 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I move the dash 4, which I asked Legislative Council for a short 48 hours ago, I have to mention how hard they work, particularly Cindy Hunt, and thank her for getting this to us so quickly. And with that, I move the dash 2, the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 392A. I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate. I will retract my motion and make a new one. I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 392A.
Representative Dahl has moved the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 392, dated 5807. Is there discussion on the dash 2?
And the only first, Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Is the dash 2, is that the parents opt out?
No, it's coming.
That's the dash 4.
Dash 2 amendment reads as follows. The State Board of Education shall adopt rules to ensure a child who is 6 years of age and beginning public school for the first time is placed in consultation with the child's parent or guardian in a grade level that's appropriate for the child's development.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I would be voting no on this dash 2.
Okay, that's fine.
Let me comment.
Go ahead, comment.
The only purpose of the dash 2 is to make sure parents are consulted.
That is correct.
And how a child is placed, right?
You want both of these, 2 and 4.
This one's first, and this one says the parent should be consulted. Okay. And then after we pass this one, we're going to get that one that has the opt-out clause.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
I oppose dash 2.
Very good.
Thank you. So the board understands.
Very good.
I don't want the 6 there at all.
Very good. All right.
Would you
call the roll on the dash 2, please, Andy?
Representative Clem.
Excused.
Representative Dolan.
Aye.
Representative Greenlake.
Aye.
Representative Call.
Aye.
Representative Crumlin.
Excused.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Rowland.
Aye.
Representative Rizak.
No.
Chair Buckley.
Aye. So amended, and I would entertain a motion on the dash four.
On the dash fours, I move the dash four amendment to Senate Bill 392A, and for the record, this will bring the parent into the decision-making process and discuss maturation as well as parents' opinion.
Representative Dahl has moved the dash four amendment to Senate Bill 392A. Is there a discussion?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
I want to make sure this dash four amendment in the subsection, I believe it's three on section five, I want to make sure parents or guardian have a right to opt out. I want to make sure this language is clear.
Representative, the language appears to me to say the board shall establish procedures where an exemption from compulsory attendance may be granted to the parent or legal guardian. I'm not sure whether I can guarantee you
that it is a may.
They shall establish procedures, but the wording does say that it's may be granted, not shall be granted.
Okay, so because of that ambiguity, I'm going to vote no on this dash four. So.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I just think we're creating a bill here that, you know, originally it came in and we're talking about truancy, and I'm okay with that, and I could support a bill that addressed truancy when a parent makes that decision to put their child. I have not been convinced in all the testimony we've received, extra research that I've done, that we need to change the mandatory age from 7 to 6. I also refer the committee to Senate Bill
He's informing Representative Clem where we are.
We passed a bill on amendment to Senate Bill 215, which in here addresses the fact that if a parent puts a child in school at 5 or 6 years old, that they don't have to pay extra tuition. So we've got a conflict here. Was already in existence. It already takes care of the fact that if the parent wants to do it, they can do it. I think that we're making a mistake here. I researched the state of Washington has 8 years old. The research that I've done on Mr. Google was that most of the states are concerned about lowering the top line. In other words, going from 18 to 16 as far as mandatory. And I've got, you know, I've researched that I can give the article. I think we're making a mistake here. I understand the truancy issue, and if the bill would address truancy by itself, then I would have been glad to try to work with the committee and support that. But I'm opposed to this very strongly.
Thank you, Representative. I believe when you use the word Google, Representative Dahlem gets a percent of royalties.
Small cut.
Small. Any further discussion on the dash four amendments?
May I bring just one more point, Mr.
Representative?
I think this bill is good intended, but I think it should be reversed. We need to keep the current on the status at this time, but if any child is bright enough to enroll early 6, then we should allow them instead of require 6 years and opt out anyone else. I don't think it's a good policy.
Thank you, Representative. And children at the age of 5 are allowed currently to enroll. Representative Dahlem.
Yes, we had a similar bill in which we were going to give rulemaking regulation to the Department of Ed, and in a conference meeting, we sat down and ironed those things out. I would like to have some assurances from the State Board of Ed as to what this, at least what their understanding of this is. I like the amendment, but I'm not sure where it's going to go. I am convinced that there are six-year-old children that do not belong in school. I'm convinced of that. I don't know if a courtesy yes means anything, but that's what I'm going to give you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Clem, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just want to clarify. So the motion is on the A4 amendments, right? That's what we're just, A4 amendments.
Correct.
And were these, Representative Dahlem?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. I'm in support of these amendments. You know, in general, I started when I was 4, actually.
And then a week later, I turned five. I'm the youngest kid in my class, usually. Some people, sometimes a little later, but I was born September 12th, so I'd always start a little early, graduate high school at 17, then a week later turned 18, that kind of thing. And so, or enrolled in college. So, but not everybody is. So that's why the opt-out. So that's why I'm voting for these amendments.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roblin.
I understand when Senator Walker came and talked to us clearly that she was talking about compulsory attendance laws and actually having kids start at 6 years old. And I agree with that for the most part. I think that is a good time for kids to start. I like this amendment because it really treats it in the same place in the statutes that all the other exceptions lie. It does. I think it will put a lot of pressure on school boards to come up with their own policies and to do things and make those kinds of decisions. So I can go along with this amendment because it hasn't changed the substance of what the bill is. So.
Thank you, Representative. What's your call?
I'm just fine with it.
Just fine and dandy. Andy, would you call a roll call on the Dash 4 amendment, please?
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative Dahl?
Yes.
Representative
Greenlee? Yes.
Aye.
Representative
Crumble? Excused.
Representative
Glenn? And no.
Representative
Roblin?
Aye.
Representative
Wisnett?
No.
Aye. So amended, I would entertain a motion on the bill itself.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 398 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dahl has moved Senate Bill 392 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
I'm going to vote no again, but what I'd like to do, I want to study more on this issue until the time of floor. So until the time I know, but when I have understanding better, then I might be able to vote yes. So just to clarify my position at this time.
Thank you, Representative.
Courtesy no.
Courtesy no. Any discussion? Hearing none, Andy, would you call the roll on the bill itself, please?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dahl?
We're going to find out what the difference between a courtesy no and a courtesy yes is. Courtesy yes on my own motion.
Representative
Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Crumble?
Aye.
Representative Crumble?
Excused.
Representative
Lim? No.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
No. Aye. The motion carries. And we're not going to let Representative Dahl carry this on the floor. He'll go to a Hamlet performance on this one. I don't think we can afford to do that. Vice Chair Kopp, would you be kind enough to carry this?
Yes,
off?
I will.
Thank
the
you.
Last one was too close.
You're done, Arnie. You're all done.
It's on the blacklist, Robin. Sorry right. about that. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 392 and open up the work session on Senate Bill, where am I?
Okay.
318 or?
Yeah, we can already do. I didn't know what day it was.
Okay, I'm going to open up the work session on Senate Bill 318A. And members, when last we met on this bill, the Representative Clem was in the middle of a motion, which he was kind enough, courteous enough to withdraw. And at this point, if you would like to make that motion again, it would be entertained.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash number 15 amendments to Senate Bill 318.
Representative Clem has moved the dash 15 amendments to Senate Bill 318A. Is there discussion?
Yeah, hold on a second, will you?
Absolutely.
I'm going through all these amendments.
While you look, Mr. Olson will restate.
Just to clarify for the committee, 318A changed the list of activities for school district grants awarded from the School Improvement Fund, directs the Department of Education to establish monetary rewards for school districts and programs that show extraordinary progress towards student achievement goals, declares emergency effective July 1st, 2007. The A15 amendment is very similar to the A9 amendment, which was discussed in a previous committee meeting. The change in the 15s is money will go to the education service districts, but that money must be spent on services or programs approved by their component school districts. So in other words, the ESDs, My reading of this is, my understanding of it rather, is that they must get approval from the component school districts before spending the money. And I could explain further the other aspects if there's questions.
Yeah, I've got a question about that.
Representative
Wheeler. Yes. What does it mean? I'm sorry.
Oh, they're going to get the money. Who did you call?
Representative Greenlick, you first, and then Representative.
Okay. It means they're going to get the money, regardless of what anybody thinks, but they can't spend it unless there are 12 school districts, like in our ESC, agree to spending it.
Chair Buckley, Representative Green, the exact language is, quote, "An education service district board shall expend 100% of all amounts received from the school improvement fund on services or programs that have been approved by the component school districts of the education service district through the resolution process described in ORS 334175.
Clarify that.
Yes, Representative Dahl, you want to clarify?
What that means, Representative Greenlick, is 50% of the schools plus one, or 50% of the students represented in the ESD plus one, must support the resolution.
No, I understand that. Let me see if I can clarify my question for the committee. Let's say the school never voted for a plan. But is the money going to come to the ESD whether or not they do, or do they have to have an approved plan before they end up getting the money? Sounds like they're getting the money anyway.
Representative Rubin.
My understanding of it is that they would get their money.
Correct.
But the resolution service is a part of what they have to do every year anyway with many of their services. They can't. There are certain things they can spend their money on, and there are other things they have to get resolution services approved by. So this will be part of that resolution process that they have to do anyway.
Sort of part of the way they do things anyway.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're joined by some familiar characters if you want any further clarification.
No, that's Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. This amendment really was to guarantee that 100% of the money went for school improvement activities. Currently, funds that come to the ESD are split 90-10 with the districts as it is. This just said 100% will go for this particular activity. So it's not essentially a change in public policy at all, except for the small 10% allocation.
Representative Lim, did you have questions?
No, my question has been answered.
Very good. Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I talked to Mr. Olson about this. One of my largest school districts is still concerned. The way he understood the bill, the 5-15, is that if the ESD does not have a plan, does not submit a plan that's approved by him, then that money does not go to the ESDs.
Mr. Chair, other places in the amendments will say that because of the way we'll do the math, only those grantees who apply will split the pot. So that ESD, he's correct, that ESD would not get any money to do any services, but his components, that ESD's component school districts may in fact be awardees, and they would get their share.
Ms. Wimmer-Whelan, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Lori Wimmer-Whelan, representing the Oregon Education Association.
Thank you. Okay, let me clarify that. So we take my school district, and the ESD submits a school improvement plan. The school says, I don't think that's a good idea. It's not evidence-based or whatever. We're not going to do that. So the ESD never got the money, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisdom, my understanding is that the Department of Education would review whether or not the applicants for the money are doing what they need to do in order to be to have plans for the grant. But the ESD piece of it would be exclusively for school improvement fund money. So in my vision, the way that would work timing-wise is that they would have those conversations before they ever submitted a grant proposal.
So help me out here. I need the right answer.
Well,
so if the school district doesn't think this is going to help their school improvement plan, there's no money that ESD captures.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilson, they would agree. They would work together to make sure that the ESD that desires to have a share of the grant money is doing what the districts are saying through the resolution process they'd like to see the ESD provide in terms of services related to school improvement. And then the grant would happen.
Let Representative Lippert shout this in.
If a group of school districts in, say, Central Oregon decided that they didn't want the ESD to get any money and they did not approve a resolution for this, they would not be able to ask for the money and they would not get their share. Is that correct?
That's correct. They'd be going, but the active part would be essentially the districts would say don't apply, and therefore the ESD would not apply. So I think that's the important part of that.
Representative Roman.
One more clarification. And therefore, the money that ESD would have received would be been in a general pot and would go to everybody else.
Be redivided out.
Vice Chair Kopp, do you have a question? You had your hand up there for a second.
The question is what Representative Wisnett's trying to get at. So we have 198 school districts in our state. And if only 150 of that 198 apply for the school improvement grant and 48 don't, the 48 are just out of the pie and they get nada. But if we don't do this amendment, then they get money regardless. Everybody gets 198 school districts if they apply.
If they apply. That's the important part.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Comp, the piece about the money, the way we did the math, the way it was in the current statute, it divided it by the total ADMW of the state, irrespective of how many districts applied. And we know from the one time that there was a grant that I think two or three didn't apply. Their share of the pot just sat on the table and didn't get spent by anybody. We didn't think that was what you all would probably want to see happen with the money. We thought that the amount you allocate, or that the ways and means process will allocate, the idea is that it gets spent on school improvement in the next biennium.
Well, the only follow-up I have, sir, Chair Buckley, was I just wanted to make sure that even though it has been explained twice, I just needed one more example, so thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Vice Chair Dahl.
I want to look at, we've put together the school improvement plan, and a small school does not subscribe to the plan at all. Can they file a minority report?
The takes two. Remember that a district will file for its own plan to become a participant in this. This is 4.75%.
I understand, but...
So there's sort of no... Then if they are in the ESD puts together its plan, they will have resolved their issue through the resolution process.
I have been a member of ESD.
I know you have.
That the issue would not be resolved.
Right.
So the school that does not approve the plan, but a majority of the schools do, they would simply... Because they didn't approve the plan, they would simply be left out.
No, they would receive their money. They would resolve it. They would be not, perhaps choose not to participate in whatever activity the ESD puts together, which represents a very tiny amount of what's going
4.7%.
On with the school improvement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they would be, of the 4.7, and if they were a small school, that, we don't care what size they are as long as they're not over 50%, but they would be left out, wouldn't they? And if they chose not to participate, they wouldn't get the money,
yeah,
and they wouldn't get the program.
Representative Roman, you want to take that on?
I just want to... Just because they vote against the resolution service doesn't mean when the majority wins that they couldn't participate in it.
Right. I'm past the vote.
Okay.
They voted no, and they don't think the plan has merit. So the money that would have gone to them, and it is 4.7%, but there is a way that a school would not get the money and not get the service.
Yep.
There is a way when it goes through the ESD.
Right.
They choose to use ESD services of all sorts or not, and certainly we would not want to take away their choice to or not to participate in an ESD-available service. Most of them choose to participate in ESD services. So... you know, it would become a problematic for the district whether it would choose then to participate in an ESD. They may not want to use the ESD special education services, or some of them may want to go it alone on everything. Most don't. I mean, you know, as you know, it's very unusual for districts not to choose to participate.
The point I was making, I think what Representative Wisnett was looking for, with this 4.7%, could his school, a school in his district, be denied a share of the money? And indeed, they can.
If they choose to.
If they choose to. If they choose that. Representative Wisnett, are you?
I have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
First, I've taken off my advocate hat for the school districts. Now I'm helping the ESDs. Does anything in this bill prevent a school district using an ESD for school improvement that's not under that ESD? It's not part of that.
Come over to the east or the west.
Clarifying question.
Representative Roman.
ESD provides a lot of opportunities, and some they aren't going to all come out of this fund. They come out of the other funds they get. If they have chosen to use some of those other funds to help this district in another program, they can still do that. It doesn't change that, correct?
Well, I think
that's
what...
That's the question.
Okay. Representative Wisnett,
what I'm saying is High Desert DSD has been asked by another school district to help them with their payroll and things like that. So that could, that school could apply for the improvement fund, and it would go to ESD that's not in their ESD, that's not over that school district. Is there anything prevent this from a school improvement fund being used by, okay, Burns High School, by High Desert?
Ms. Whelan, or Ozzie, go ahead.
For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the OASD Association. I reside here in Salem. Several questions have been asked. First, the most, back to your original question about if one district doesn't want to, an amount of money has been appropriated for each ESD to apply for, just like an amount has been appropriated for each district to apply for. The amount the ESD applies for can only be applied for after the local districts have designed a plan for what they're going to do with that. If, and in your, excuse me, in a sample district in the middle of our state, one district is much bigger than the others, and they would have a huge sway on whether the resolution gets passed or not. Once it's passed, if a district says, I don't want anything to do with it, even if it's being, I assume they could do that. I can't imagine why. But on the other hand, the money that they can get themselves directly from the state, they could say, I don't want to do that, and not participate also. I just can't imagine a case where once they build a plan, they wouldn't. And then the last question, can Burns get something from the High Desert ESD out of this money? I don't think so, unless the resolution process said we can sell part of this. You've got money, you can buy it. They can't go do services without the approval of their own districts.
Did I answer your question?
I appreciate all this, but I think also it might be helpful the committee has the Department of Education figured out they're going to be doing this. Is do they have, you know, they feel they understand they're going to do the rules? Are we going to have input on the rules or on how this all works and everything? I think that's important.
Very good. I'm glad to invite the department up, too, once we're sure we're through with these folks here. Representative Roblin and Representative Dahlem.
Well, I think one of the issues that Gene brought to mind to me was we have some ESDs that do... got into some entrepreneurial things where they provide services to other districts outside of their ESD region. And I guess what the question is if someone is outside of that ESD region and they get their money, could they take that money and buy services from the ESD?
That's my question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, obviously the answer to that is yes. And let's remember, I'm hopeful we're remembering there are two separate pots of money here. There's the regular money that ESDs get, and then there's this school improvement fund money. And I think when you heard Representative Wisnett, the answer no to the idea of doing payroll with it, it's because this pot is explicitly for student achievement grants. And so they could still do that out of their other pot.
Representative Dahlem.
I'd like to go back to Mr. Rose, Ozzie's example. Let's talk about the ESD has their 4.7%, and I'm going to stay with that figure, and it's important that we look at that. We're not talking humongous amounts of money, but it is money. And we've gone through the resolution, the ESD has applied, and the ESD, with their members, has decided that they will target 8th grade. They have common problems, but we have one school district that's going to do K-3. They don't need the service. They won't participate in the program, and therefore they've lost this money. Is that correct?
Sure. Representative Mr. Chair, Ozzie Rose. The problem I have with that example is I can't imagine that when you're sitting down and saying we have some resources that we don't work out a way to do it. And their plan, I can't imagine that if the one district raised that much of an objection that you wouldn't file in your plan a way to take care of that district's K-3 needs as part of the discussion of how you build the plan. And the purpose of trying to create this, involve the ESD, is to leverage the resources to create a better, a more complete program. And I didn't work for those guys all my life, but most of it. And I just can't imagine that you wouldn't develop a resolution process that would allow all the districts to participate.
What I'm talking about is the tremendous cooperation from member schools. But with only 4.7%, and when we design a program, I remember Denny Douglas struggling with how he could wrap an in-service program around K to 12 and 13 schools and allocate enough money to target a problem to be specific enough to attract teachers that would make his program worthwhile. So many would opt out. There's nothing, do what he could. But the point is, when we run the money through the ESD, it is sometimes very difficult to stretch, to bend, and to encompass all the members. And I believe it happens with almost every program we have. The ESD tries to do the most good with the most dollars, but we have now stretch the pool so broadly that perhaps we're not targeting our money as good as we could have. If we had given it to the individual schools and allowed them to pool with common interest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, Denny Douglas's example, the districts in his ESD, some of them think I have 5 and 6 and 7 kids. They're not going to be able to do anything, even with their $181 a kid that they get through the regular. They're going to have to pool their resources and build a program. And all the ESD side of it is get the ESD into that process. I don't remember 00 and different names of the districts out there, but that will, they'll have to work together and build a program and that I would suspect will involve all their money, their local money and their ESD money, because it's the only way you're going to get services to everybody.
Vice Chair Kopp.
We do have a motion.
We do have a motion?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Comment to the motion?
Yes. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
I'm going to be giving
the motion?
The motion is on the dash 4.
Dash 4.
Dash 15.
Dash 15, sorry. 15.
I've been waiting several days for this motion. Let's make sure we get it right.
Dash 15 by Representative Clem, who's moved those.
I'm going to be giving a courtesy yes to this motion because what we're talking about is a much bigger issue with the same ramifications in a number of areas. And my perspective, to put it simply so it makes sense to me, by having the dash 15s, the money will go to the ESDs, and whatever happens to do a school improvement plan, those plans will be written in all good faith to help students. My point is that this results with $11 million to go to the ESDs, and we've heard testimony after testimony during this session how districts with particularly declining enrollment need every dime that they can get. And my experience tells me that it's going to take a minimum of staff time to oversee this collectively, probably at least two FTE. And it may or may not, but those two FTE could be teachers in a classroom. This is another layer that is on a big mountain that needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I will share with you that my superintendent from the Ashland School District, which does have significant decline in enrollment challenges, is very supportive of the Dash 15 amendments called this morning and felt it would be beneficial.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I need ODE to come up, but I would ask the chair in writing to be sure that ODE implements or briefs the Interim Education Committee as soon as possible on the implementing rules of this program.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative. Further discussion on the Dash 15s? Hearing none. Andy, would you call the roll on the Dash 15s, please?
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. So amended. I'd like to thank Vice Chair Kopp and Representative Wisnett for both pushing on this issue to try to get something that works for the most people possible. And I do appreciate your work on this. Vice Chair Dahlem, I would entertain a motion on the bill.
I move Senate Bill 318A to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dahlem has moved Senate Bill 318A to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion on the bill itself? Representative Roblin.
Thank you. I couldn't get away without saying a few things. I would hope that the next session we have a real clear conversation about this fund. From my perspective, what we have done today is something that is necessary because of the school funding issues that we have and making sure that we get enough money out to school districts so in places like ours they stay open for the whole year and other places they can actually put some things, maybe add some new things. But the real intention of this law and this fund was to help the state become proactive in targeting effective plans that they felt were important and just targeting them. It wasn't to have $240 million. It was never intended to have, I think, that much money and broadly target, but to narrow it down and target some other things that we want to see could make real differences in education. And so I would hope we would have that discussion do it. I think this is the right thing for right now, but I would like to see this fund turned back into the kind of thing that I think can be helpful for the state and education in general by targeting things in the future.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahlem.
I feel obligated since one of our members is missing. This committee, in talking about the ESD, I think we have a much larger picture to look at, and that is we have an experiment going on with ESDs right now. And I think during the interim we have to look at how's that experiment working. I am a firm believer in the viability and the necessity of ESDs. But I think during the interim, we have to look at our very small schools, we have to look at our very small ESDs. They're in trouble, and we have to decide. We've heard that in this committee. Are we going to let them die? Are we going to let them wither? Or are we going to make them something viable? This bill, I think, gives us an opportunity to see that we have to do something for our ESDs, something with or without them. But thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Dahlem. Further discussion? Hearing none, I will just add the comment, thank you to all who worked on this bill in putting your energies towards it. I think it will be a great step forward for education in our state. With that, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 The motion carries. The chair carried this one on the floor, and we'll see what happens then. At this point, we'd like to open up a... I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 318A and open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 800A. And Mr. Olson, if you would be so kind, and Senator, would you join us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 800A requires an accountant under contract to perform a school district audit to make determinations regarding the district's accounting systems, compliance with legal requirements, and conducting financial affairs. Requires the school district board to determine measures necessary to correct any deficiencies disclosed in the accountant's opinion or in the audit report, and to adopt resolutions setting forth proposed corrective measures. Requires the Secretary of State and Department of Education within 60 days of receiving a school district board resolution to acknowledge the board's plan to correct deficiencies or to notify a board of deficiencies that, if not corrected, could result in the withholding of funds. It allows the Secretary of State or Department of Education to certify to the Superintendent of Public Instruction the failure of a school district board to take corrective action during the course of two successive audits. It requires the Superintendent of Public Instruction, upon receipt of certificate, to withhold 10% of payments from the state school fund otherwise distributed to the school district. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's an A4 amendment in front of you. My understanding is, having been involved in the process, this is a consensus between the Oregon Society of CPAs and the Secretary of State's office and others, including the witnesses, with some technical fixes. Those would delete all references to governmental when referring to generally accepted accounting principles, delete language directing an accountant to determine if the school district has established appropriate accounting systems and internal controls, would add language referring to ORS 297465, delete most of the language referring to opinion, delete language directing a school district to take action to establish appropriate accounting systems and internal controls, replace the reference to the National Council on Government Accounting and the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants with a reference to the Government Accounting Standards Board, and change the application of the audits from language stating that they are contracted for periods ending on or after the effective date of this 2007 Act. I know it's a bit confusing, but they're technical amendments, and again, they were formed through consensus, is my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senator, welcome to our committee. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And I do appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. This bill is a result of our experience in a school district located in my Senate district. The administration of that district was accused of malfeasance and misappropriation of funds. Following a district investigation, the administration reported no harm, no foul. When the district patrons asked to see the report, they said, come. And basically, that report has never been made public, and so the patrons have no idea whether it was properly addressed or not. As you know, that it was appealed because of the attorney-client privilege in that to the Supreme Court, and the attorney-client privilege part of it was upheld. A different bill, Senate Bill 671, is dealing with that part of it.
Senator, for the record, would you introduce yourself and say what district you're from?
Sure, I will. I'm State Senator Doug Witts, District 28.
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 800 requires more accountable audits of school district financial performance. The bill requires the school district board to correct all deficiencies disclosed in the audit report. If the corrections are not accepted by the Secretary of State or the Department of Education, on two consecutive audits, the Department of Public Instruction must withhold 10% of the school fund grant until those deficiencies are corrected. The A4 amendments simply make technical corrections that the certified smart accountants tell us were necessary to make this thing work properly. And with that, I would just like to thank Mr. Green and Mr. Bennett and Mr. Hibner of the Secretary of State's office and the certified accountants to further help on this bill.
Very good. Thank you very much, Senator. Mm-hmm. Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We had the opportunity in the Senate to work extensively with Senator Whitsitt on this bill. And in the process of discussing the entire area of audits, one of the things that I think surprised us was, as you got into the school district audit law, unlike cities and counties, you could have management letters attached to audits describing changes that needed to be made, some things that should be done, but no requirement that they be done or that, in fact, that it be responded to. And it concerned us. We have, for several sessions, many sessions, relied upon the fact that one of the very effective oversights out there on school districts has been these financial audits. Then to find out that, in fact, a portion of the audit could just go by seemed to us to kind of belie the confidence we had in these audits. So in talking with the senator, we determined that at least these audits ought to be comparable to what's requested or required of cities and counties. And really the language that I think is most operable are on the A4 amendments on page 1, lines 12 through 16, which require a response and action by the school board to take corrective action. And at a minimum, we think that's just absolutely what must be done with these audits. So we were very pleased to get this piece of legislation through the Senate. We hope through this committee and the House. We think this is really one of the best bills related to school district accountability coming through this session. This really is a very, very good bill. We hope it will move right on through. It's the kind of thing that makes local control mean something. If you're going to have local control, you've got to also have some local responsibility to go with it, and there were some missing responsibility factors here. So I appreciate your support for the bill and its amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. As Mr. Bennett said, we worked very closely with Senator Whitson on that, on the bill and on these amendments, and with the certified public accountants, as well as Chuck Hibner from the Secretary of State's office. We believe the Dash A4s are technical amendments that are needed to make the bill work. And as Mr. Bennett said, what this does is it puts school districts on par with what cities and counties have to do. All municipal corporations in the state, under ORS Chapter 297, have to have a municipal financial audit done every year. Under ORS 297-466, cities and counties have to respond to anything that an auditor may find in the report. We were a little flabbergasted to find that school districts don't have to do that. And that's what this bill does. It makes us respond to anything that our outside auditor, who we've hired to look at our numbers and our books to say, if there's anything here, is there a problem? And I think, as Senator Woods had said, if in two consecutive times we don't respond, the state superintendent of public instruction can pull 10% of our state school fund monies. That's a wake-up call to school districts when you start talking about taking away state school fund dollars. I think they ought to respond to it. When I asked Chuck Hibner from the Secretary of State's office a question about, well, let's say it's something along the lines of we have a really small school district and they've got two people that work in their business office. One has check signing authority and the other one doesn't. Is it such that we can say, look, we're just not big enough to hire somebody else to have check signing authority. Would that be okay with you? And he goes, yeah. We're not going to get into that level of management. But if it's the fact that nobody's turning in receipts for which they're seeking reimbursement, that's something that board should deal with in a resolution. But if it's a business practice just based on the size of the school district, that's not something we get into. It's really on the accountability piece to make sure that public funds are being spent for what they're supposed to be spent for. And to be honest with you, I think all three of us at the dais here were surprised when we found out school districts don't have to respond. And we think they ought to respond. And as Mr. Bennett said, it is one of the bills that we see as an accountability piece this session so that our taxpayers know if there's something that's found in our audit, we're going to respond to it and we're going to take appropriate measures at the highest level in our school districts, our locally elected school board members, to fix the problem.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Questions? Members? Vice Chair Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. The only question I have, and it's probably for Mr. Green, do the CPAs have a legal definition? On page 1, on section 1, on line 6, it states that school district has followed generally accepted accounting principles. Is there a CPA definition for generally accepted accounting principles? What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Comp, I have a packet of email traffic here that I think the committee administrator has seen as well. And that is one of the technical terms that the certified public accountants do use as it relates to audits and generally acceptable accounting standards and generally acceptable accounting practices. That's something that is a term of art that they know when they go get their CPA license.
That's
but your administrator
all I was
may need
wondering.
To answer that as well.
I thought that might be the situation, but I wanted to make sure.
Mr. Olson, do you want to follow
that? Just a clarification, yeah, the A4 amendments help tighten up, I think, some of the language to make sure it's in line with other language used by CPAs and others.
Okay. Representative Roblin.
Just a couple questions, if I may. The first one has to do with there were some major changes made with regard to public entities and property they own with regard to how it would be accounted for, and we've been going through that for a number of years, making sure that we had the value for it, and it became part of the audit as time went on, and then how you depreciated equipment and all those kinds of things with public buildings. And so for a while, almost all of the district ones that I saw, and including all the other public ones, had problems. They would say, except for this, and it's working on. I guess, would the plan be what was necessary to have? Because everybody was working on it. They were just trying to figure out how to get their full inventory into the deal so that they could actually monitor what was coming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin, one of the things I wanted to let you know is in our association, the Oregon School Boards Association, we also run an association called the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. They're the business managers out there. When I ran this issue by them, they brought that up, and they said that this would be part of that as well. But if an auditor found that there was something wrong with the way they were depreciating an asset or with regard to disclosure of the property that they owned and what was going on, that the board would have to address that through the resolution and say, this is what we're doing with regard to this. We're getting up to those generally acceptable accounting practices and standards.
Okay. Paul?
And the second one was, one of the issues that some of us caused for our districts was that there's another part of the budget where you make an estimate of how much money is going to come in, and then you could spend it. So student body accounts were an example that we audit very closely. But sometimes you would do really well in fundraising, and you would exceed what they had anticipated, and so it would come out as a deficiency in your report because you spent more than you said you were going to spend, even though you were only spending money that the kids brought in and spent out for themselves. So it shows up, and I would hope that we wouldn't want to say that the correction would be you can't raise money next year, or we just, you know, take another estimate. So I used to get harassed about this because
because you were a high school principal.
And because the only blemish on the deal was that your kids did more than they should have done. So I don't want
to. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin, I think that's one of those issues that Mr. Hibner from the Secretary of State's office would say. Okay. That's not going to. They're really going to look at, when someone made a reimbursement, were there receipts there, and did somebody sign off on that being okay? It's more really not those, what I would call the ticky-tacky things, like kids sold more licorice or, you know, jerky than they were supposed to this year.
I'm glad you said licorice.
Fully enunciate. That's great, yes.
But as far as issues like that, that's not something they're really going to be looking at. And remember, under our local budgeting law, if it's different than by more than 10% of what the budget was that was adopted by the locally elected school board, we have to reconstitute our budget committee and get approval for that.
Right. And my last one is just a comment. And I absolutely like the fact that we're doing this. It has not a problem. I think our districts have done it in the past. We looked forward at the high school where I was at. We looked forward to the audit every year, and they did all of our student body accounts because, from my perspective, it is the greatest protection for people that you're doing the right thing. And they give you some great recommendations sometimes. And I will tell you that I think every accountant's job is to make sure that they find something that they can give you a comment on. So, and that's okay. I mean, it's a good thing. And you clear up all of your little procedures. You find and get people in the right places. And I think it is very important to do it. It's very important that we respond to any things that they find wrong, and I think this is a great bill.
Thank you, Representative Wizard. Did you have anything?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much. First of all, are we going to have other witnesses?
These are the only witnesses signed up on this bill.
So the accountant's not going to come up. Thank you, Senator Wizard, for bringing this forth. Good idea. We need it. I've been a strong advocate of additional funding for education, but with accountability, so we need more and more of this. So maybe these gentlemen can help me with some of my questions. Representative Roblin talked about he had been doing audits. So how many school districts had not been reporting and publicly releasing their audits in the past?
It's a public document, Representative, so all audits are released. What wasn't happening, and I can't give you a number.
You can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's
a, there's no number reported yeah. on who was stealing.
But yeah. The answer would probably be zero. But, yeah. It's
and, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, if I may, on our municipal financial audits for school districts and education service districts in the state, as well as public charter schools, we have to file that audit report. It has to be announced before the board. It has to be shown to our locally elected school board in a public meeting. It's a public document. We have to file that audit with the Secretary of State's office and the Department of Education every year.
Okay. Thank you. I had so you mentioned a very key word, because I don't see if this is required of ESDs, and I think they should be.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, if you take a look at it, and it says it, municipal financial audit, because this is amendment to the municipal financial audit law, they are a municipal corporation. And if you take a look, I believe it is on, well, I'm looking, I'm unfortunately, I don't have the Angross version of my bill file, but I'm looking at line 12 on page 1 of the original bill, and it says, each school district and education service district shall make full annual financial reports to the public. I think that may have been changed, but if they fall under the municipal financial audit law of ORS Chapter 297, that includes school districts, it includes education service districts, and it includes public charter schools.
Okay. Last question then. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some financial audits, I was on a board and we get required annual audits, and some of the audits would have some comments about your operation. Does the statute require them to comment about, you know, you're spending too much money on books, you're spending too little money on books? Does this audit require any sort of reports like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, I'm not sure. I know that Chuck Hibner from the Secretary of State's office is not in the room today, and he would probably be better to answer that. But if you take a look at ORS Chapter 297 on what they are auditing, it's a pretty extensive audit of our financial statements, of everything financial matters. I don't believe that they get into the issue of you bought too many new textbooks this year. But it is an audit of all receipt money in, all expenditures out, any reserve funds that the district may be sitting on, any litigation funds the district, I mean, any fund that a school district is holding goes under significant scrutiny each year.
I have two real quick ones then. Will the Department of Education share these audits to say, you know, we found a problem here? Will there be any sort of cross-tail information on this, their analysis of this to report to other school districts? You might want to look for this or something like that. Is there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, I can't speak for the Department of Education, but I can tell you what our business managers do in the school districts. And again, the Oregon Association of School Business Officials is in our shop. We help them put on their annual conference. And each year, we have a workshop, several workshops that are put on by both municipal financial auditors, certified public accountants, business managers that have been longtime business managers in school districts about things that have popped up that are problems that need to be dealt with. And I think that's safe to say for every professional organization in the state. When you find a best practice or you find a problem, you address those issues.
Okay. That's the last comment, Mr. Chair. I think this is good. I appreciate, again, Senator Wissett bringing and everyone that worked on it. I think we still need to look and provide as much accountability as possible to the public, and I think that still requires some performance audits as much as we can, either through the chalkboard proposal or the other proposal we've looked at. We need to continue to try to fund and look at performance audits to convince the people that we're using their money wisely.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Donald.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. I think back to all of those years when I just assumed, and the clerk just assumed, that we addressed every issue. And we had a process that first the auditors came and you answered a million questions. And then when they exited, you did an exit audit, and they would let you know of the fine things that you had to fine-tune. And you'd get an informal letter, and finally the formal letter. Mm-hmm. And to think that a school district would go more than 2 years without fixing something that was in that final... And I think my colleague has... when we had to do those inventories of school property and establish value, everybody struggled with that. But this is a good bill. We're simply saying that if you're not fixing the things you're supposed to be fixing, something's going to happen. I can't imagine that Mr. Green has in his association very many that don't. But if they aren't, they should. This is a good bill, and we should support it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you. My question is a very simple one. And while the school district, after audit, if they are not complying, then they are going to withheld 10% of the funding, which is a lot of money. While we are trying to penalize the district, but actually we are penalizing the students, not giving them the enough funding. And then this is a very severe problem. And I'm not sure also how practical it is try to withhold 10%. I'm sure it is a threat. But in worst cases, so if they don't get the 10%, it's going to affect the district and the whole children. And can you address some of those issues?
Yeah. Chair Buckley, Representative Lim. The 10% penalty after two consecutive audits where the problem has not been addressed, that 10% is refundable as soon as they address the problem. And if the, in my opinion, if the district is so remiss in that they won't for 2 years address a problem that is brought to them by the audit, then there is a need to have some type of a hammer to see that they do that. Okay. And as soon as they do that, they get their money back.
Okay. Follow up.
Representative Lim?
Instead of money, is there any other way that we can penalize them somehow other than just money? Because I'm concerned they're penalizing the children.
Mr. Chairman, this is a reasonably standard description of a penalty under other aspects of education regulation. This is not off the mark in terms of how other requirements are enforced through this threat of penalty. Representative Lim, I think we will be absolutely shocked if there is anywhere a district that would allow this to go for two audit cycles. For one thing, you've got a responsibility on licensed professionals in terms of the administration of the district who would be facing additional problems, I think, if they were not responding in that way derelict. And you have elected school boards with a responsibility to respond in this as well. So, for a variety of reasons, it would be remote. It would be so unlikely. It would be, I think, reportable here and certainly a reason for us to be responding to if we had a district that derelict in its responsibility.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, we did this on par with the idea of, as I said before, school districts currently on an annual basis have to file their audits with the Secretary of State's office and the Department of Education. If you don't do so by a date set in statute, and I can't remember the date off the top of my head right now, it's with the threat of you don't get your state school funds until we see that audit report. Mm-hmm. And that has worked as an impetus in the last several years for several school districts to understand if you miss that date, you don't get your next month's state school fund payment. And while they understand that the funds and the monies go to provide educational services to boys and girls, they also have a duty to get that information in because it is one of the huge checks and balances we have on our finances in our system. So we mirrored it with that's currently in statute. And I would agree with Mr. Bennett. You have school administrators and school board members who take their jobs and responsibilities very seriously. They get in it to provide educational services to boys and girls. And 10% is a small kind of slap upside the head to say, you need to deal with this. You haven't dealt with it for 2 years now. Deal with this. The minute they deal with it, as Senator Whitsitt has said, then they get their state school fund payments.
Thank you. Representative Dom, you have one more comment?
I think it's imperative that a school district open its books to a disinterested outside third party that knows bookkeeping. And when those people say something is not generally accepted accounting principles, that they fix it. That's just good business. If they refuse to fix it, and they are few and far between, but I remember the one where the receipts were not appropriately documented and the superintendent was paying his car payments with school money. So 10% may look like it's punitive to students, but on those rare occasions when the money is being stolen, the students are being punished. So it's just good public policy. Open the books, give an outsider a look, and if he says fix it, fix it. That's a simple answer.
Thank you, Representative. Jim, thank you so much for bringing this proposal forward today. And we are in a works... brief comment? Go ahead, Representative.
I mean, it is important we note on the record that this is a financial audit, not a performance audit.
Correct.
So it really is only about assuring the financial systems of the school district are in order. That's so basic, it's just hard to imagine.
Nothing ever happened.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Kahn.
Well, paying for the car, that seems reasonable.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move that -4 amendments to Senate Bill 800A.
Vice Chair Kahn has moved the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 800A. Is there any further discussion?
No.
Representative Rowland's teasing me. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so amended. Vice Chair Kahn.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 800A as amended to the House with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Kahn has moved Senate Bill 800A to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion on the bill? Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll? Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion carries. Representative Dahlem, would you...
I would be delighted to carry
this. This could be consent calendar, but if you want to carry this?
No.
Okay. Representative Garrard wants to carry this bill. Representative Garrard wants to?
Yeah.
It's his bill? All right. Are you all right with that, Representative Dahlem? Representative Garrard carries the bill?
Just fine with me.
You can speak on it as well.
Just fine with me.
Thank you very much, members. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 800A. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 989A. And as Mr. Olson reminds us what it is, I'll invite Representative Maurer to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 989A expands the type of public bodies exempt from the insurance code requirements related to health insurance coverage to include public bodies whose number of covered employees and dependents and retired employees and dependents is at least 500. There is no amendment. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Maurer, welcome to the Education Committee. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. It's an honor to sit in front of this august body. And I just want to take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about this bill. And this bill could have been in several different committees. Could have been in health care, consumer and business services. But it's here, and there's a history to that. But this bill is about three things. It's about equality, it's about aligning language to the current reality, and it's about permitting public bodies to be innovative and creative.
Representative, before you go through the history, would you be kind enough to introduce yourself and the district you come from, please?
I have to ask the Senator, too.
I think
Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3, serving most of Josephine County.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. The language in Senate Bill 989 has been around quite a long time, and there were two sources of that kind of spurred this on. One was Grants Pass School District Number 7 that wanted to be self-insured, and also Coos Bay, Health District, a County Health Authority. And those two entities had a great interest in seeing this language change and becoming more current. Obviously, Senate Bill 426 kind of precluded the school district piece, but the language still remains there. That did not take out school districts. But what it did do is it took out some, on page 2, you'll notice on line 6, it took out the ability for joint programs to aggregate a pooling figure of $500,000. In the past, there have been public bodies that have, I will say, gamed the system. A school district of a couple hundred would get together with a school district of a couple, and that has happened. And with their aggregate premiums would easily exceed $500,000. T- Today, that would mean that a pooled public body, which could be an irrigation district, a county, et cetera, could have something less than 50 people in a pool and be self-insured, and the insurance commission saw that as a problem. We went through a number of iterations of language, and it was the governor's office that came up with the language that you see before you, and in my opinion, that's probably the best language that has come up, because it does two things. One is it meets the needs of the public bodies and treats everybody the same, and it also does not allow for gaming of the system, so that the true intent and protection of public funds is maintained. And with that, I will close my comments.
Thank you so much, Representative. Members, any questions? Representative Mauer?
Yes, I
do. Representative Vina?
Here, Representative Mauer. If these were private organizations, they would be covered by the ERISA regulations, which would define something about their plan. Being that they're covered, that they're public agencies and therefore not covered under ERISA, I assume they're not covered under ERISA, and they won't be regulated by the insurance division, what does regulate them? How are they regulated?
What regulates their insurance policy? Is that
their self-insured plan? Mm-hmm.
Yes, Chair Buckley, Representative Green, they are I'm going to shoot from the hip and actually say that I believe that they are covered by ERISA and are not covered by the state insurance laws. And so an example would be if we put a mandate, quote, a health insurance mandate at the state level, that insurance mandate would not necessarily or would not apply to that self-insured body.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rubin.
I guess you picked the 500, believing that that's enough to make it a viable organization. I mean, the old one with the dollars, those dollars are getting to be so little that it wouldn't necessarily be there. But self-insurance is a very risky thing for public entities, and especially in health insurance when you have catastrophic kinds of claims, if you haven't taken care to insure at least those. So are you feeling comfortable that this 500 number is that place where it breaks? That
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, the reality is that in the private business, that those numbers go well below 250 for a self-insurance pool. Clearly, though, the public interest is a little different. In a business, a private business, which can declare bankruptcy in a public body, which can declare bankruptcy, but the consequences would fall to the state or to the federal. Somebody's going to pay the bill. Taxpayers are. So it quite clearly that the ability of these public bodies to maintain their viability is important. And 500, the insurance commission, and if they're here, they would testify, but they're quite comfortable with those numbers. And in fact, in Wisconsin, they allow school boards or school districts to be self-insured down to 100 persons in their pool, and that is the only state that goes that low. And I was in contact with their with many of the districts within Wisconsin, as well as some of the insurers, and they have had no problems in that state. But I'm not sure I would suggest that we would go that.
Do you follow?
Yeah. Just to follow up on that same line, do you have any statistics on companies, private companies, that chose to do that, that are 500 more, that have done it for a long time and been successful or not successful?
Chair Buckley and Representative Rowland, I don't have the statistics. I do know an example is there's a company in Roseburg that has, I want to say, less than 10 and is self-insured. And really the bottom line is self-insurance is, you're not out there totally swinging in the wind. You reinsure, so you buy, essentially it's a a catastrophic policy with, say, a $100,000 deductible, as an example, and then you have substantial reserves.
Right. Representative Dull.
I think you answered my question, Representative Maurer, but you do lay off a major portion of the risk, and you do buy reinsurance, don't you?
Yeah, Chair Buckley, Representative Dahl, that's critical. And,
sure.
And districts or any public body that takes this on has got to be sophisticated enough to do their homework. And if they have a union, that the unions have to buy into this.
Absolutely.
Because if the employees and management don't collectively buy into it, it's not going to work.
And with the reinsurance, it's usually at several levels, so you've amortized your risk really over a very large pool anyway, I believe, haven't you?
Maybe. Chair Buckley, Representative Dahl, that is correct. You do spread that risk, but the bottom line is you would still be held accountable for a substantial deductible, and that's where your reserves are critical.
And then a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that you have a professional administrator that is schooled in the minutiae of insurance.
Chair Buckley, Representative Dahl, no, we hire anybody off the street.
And where I'm going with this is it's not a simple matter of putting your money in a sock and waiting for somebody to get sick. You also have a performance audit and a financial audit annually, and the performance audit deals with turnaround time on claims, deals with adjudicating claims. You do participate in both of those type of audits, I'm sure.
Yes, Chair Buckley, Representative Donald, thank you for pointing that out. That is correct. A public body that's going to engage in this is going to have a contract with a TPM or a third-party manager that is going to deal with actually claims adjudication. But your business folks, the people that are really in charge of and personnel that are dealing with the employees, that they really have got to be sharp people.
So I guess the point I'm making is when we talk about self-insured, we can rest assured that people that know the business and know how to lay off the risk are involved. So we're not looking at a fly-by-night group of public people getting together and putting together an insurance pool simply to save money. And they may save some money, but we've given them an opportunity to do for themselves something they choose to do.
Yeah. And Chair Buckley and Representative Dahl, that is correct. But there is, I mean, this is not totally risk-free. That there have been instances where public bodies have made bad decisions. And so I think it was the Insurance Commission's interest in changing this language, which helped the bill along, and the governor's office, which had an interest in changing the language to see this bill and having the language be appropriate for everybody's protection.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I do want to put on the record, the effect of this bill is to really reduce the minimum group size by a lot. Under the old bill, it was 500 or, I guess, 1,000 employees and retirees, not counting dependents. And now we're talking about 500 employees or retirees, including dependents. And they're probably an average of, I don't know, 1.5 dependents per employee. So this really is making that group a lot smaller than it was under the current, current legislation. Is that, does that trouble you at all?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, it does not bother me, and I think that the words dependent was not an addition that I had originally thought of, but it was an addition that was brought forth by the Insurance Commission. But it is language that would be consistent because groups are not looked at by employees. They're looked at the total number of lives that fall within that group.
Well, it depends. Certainly the health and welfare trusts are by employees because the contribution is by employee, but that's not good. Yeah, I mean, it's going to have that effect.
And it does.
It doesn't bother me that much.
Thank you, Representative.
Still go bankrupt and the taxpayers will pay for it, as you pointed out.
My school district is currently working under this.
Tell them to be careful.
And they're going to be very careful. We also have a company, Derek's Incorporated in Ashland, which I believe has about 50 employees. So far, they're doing very well with a small insurance pool, but it does carry its risk. There's a real
just one final thing. I agree. I don't have a real problem with the 500, but the issue when you talk about public groups is having reserves. And ERISA still requires that they keep those reserves separate from the other account, doesn't it? I mean,
so does this.
So does this, doesn't it? So
yeah, this requires separate.
I mean, they have to keep that reserve because it's so easy for public entities when things go bad to start looking at reserves as funding sources, and they can't do that in this kind of a situation. I just want to make sure this is clearly stated.
And Representative Buckley, Representative Roblin, I think in my experience with the public body doing this, which was School District Number 7 in Grants Pass, that was key to their whole planning. And one of the issues that really spurred this bill was that they had to pool because they didn't have enough employees. That they, when they pooled, they were with a district that had a different philosophy about the reserve. And the district I was in, Grants Pass, was very conservative about the reserve. And when the other district did not carry enough reserve, that's what caused a problem. And it wasn't that there was a financial problem. They just could foresee this as an issue. And you are correct. It has got to be separate. And these people, innovation and risk, I think, kind of go hand in hand, but there can be a substantial payoff for those who are good at it.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. Thank you for your time today in front of our committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Wilson, we have one other
witness. Yes, Mr. Chair. David Martin from Senator Berger's office.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Martin. I'm staff for Senator Verger. I have some remarks, but I think I'll maybe start with Representative Greenlich's comment. The 1,000 employees for the joint program, it also had the or 500,000. So for our Bay Area hospital, they were doing the or 500,000, so they actually had 438 employees covered because they were able to hit the $500,000 mark. So there were some concerns about how the districts need to be able to handle the risk. So we were approached by the Bay Area Health District to try and help figure out a way to work out fixing this section. They are able to take the risk. They've been self-sufficient since 1986. They have over $100 million in annual expenses and over $50 million in funded depreciation reserves. They've been self-insured for over 20 years. About 10 years ago, they did lose 55% of their employees to a union health plan. And so this put them out of compliance with the single public body. So in order to combat this, they joined up with the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board, which put them in the joint program, gave them the $500,000. So the original thought was to just add the $500,000 requirement to the single public body, but in talking with the insurance division and the governor's office, it was determined that this was way too low. I think right now that was in 1981, so it should be $2.25 million today. And so we'd have to continue to adjust it every 2 years in front of the legislature because with medical inflation rising, there would never be a good amount to set that at. So with the help from the governor's office, we added in the dependents so they were able to reach the 500 employees, and I think it created a good balance for everyone. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Question? They put on the record how they managed to get help from the governor's office?
I'm sure they simply asked.
That never occurred to me.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you so much for your time today. Members, we are in a work session on this bill.
I'll move the bill.
Representative Greenland.
I'll move Senate Bill 989 be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlich has moved Senate Bill 989A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion carries. Representative Maurer, would you be kind enough to carry this bill to the floor for us? Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 989. And members, we actually have one more left. Senate Bill, I'm going to open up the work session on Senate Bill 23A. Mr. Olson, if you'd be so kind.
Senate Bill 23A expands the definition of eligible students for participation in the Expanded Options Program. It changes the program notification requirements, provides a process for determining duplicate courses and appealing those determinations, directs the school district and eligible post-secondary institution to negotiate in good faith financial agreement for payment of instructional costs, provides process for parties to appeal to the Department of Education to determine whether negotiations were conducted in good faith, allows a waiver for districts who negotiate in good faith but do not reach an agreement, allows public charter schools to participate in the Expanded Options Program, allows school district to request waiver of requirements of participation in the program, declares an emergency, and was effective July 1st, 2007. It was sent from the Subcommittee on Education and Innovation to the full committee with a due pass recommendation 6-0 with one excused.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Representative Dolan, would you like to fill us in a little bit in on the bill?
Yes, we put together a work group with the Department of Education and Oregon Education Association, and we determined that this bill did not need a change here in committee. We can handle it in rulemaking, and I was off to do two jobs. Down to Ledge Council to see if there was a definition for financially able. And there really is not a legal definition for that. So I'm off to legislative finance, and I find that we do have a beginning fund balance figure that might do the job. I'm sure it will. I'll talk with ODE, talk with OEA, and I'm sure we can come up with a figure. And with that, I would ask that we pass the bill out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Dolan. Members, are there any questions on this bill that Representative Dolan could answer for you?
I might make one more statement. My recommendation for the record, because we will not see this bill again, is that we, if a school has a beginning fund balance of over 5% of receipts, that the opt-out not be applicable. It would seem they'd have plenty of money then. But we'll talk about that. With that, I move Senate Bill 23A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dolan has moved Senate Bill 23 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the bill? Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Schlum? Aye.
Representative Aye.
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 Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion carries. Representative Dolan, would you carry this bill?
I'll carry the bill.
I appreciate your time and attention today, members. We got to the full agenda. I'm very pleased.
Do we have a budget?
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 23A. And were there questions or comments for the good day order?
No, were you going to have to justify the ways and means about a budget?
Oh, for this one or for no budget?
A different one.
You can thank Representative Dalma, Representative Kopp reminds me that this is the period of time, generally, any of the bills that we have in ways and means that come through our committee that you have a particular tie to, it's imperative that you talk to ways and means people now. They are in the midst of trying to decipher when policy bills would be pulled together with agency budgets or heard separately, but we are in the final crunch. If you haven't heard back on a bill you're particularly fond of, it's time to check in on the bills.
They've got 200 bills, more than 200 policy bills, none of which have yet been assigned to even subcommittees.
So communication.
I'm not convinced they are about to work on it.
Right. Well, the meeting that we had today at lunch, there was some confusion over what the chicken or egg is going to happen here. So I would just want to extend to members that if there is a bill that you do have concern about, it's better to be proactive than non-active.
Mr. Chair.
Was it Dahl?
Could I please make a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Clem to vote on Senate Bill 800A? With the dashboard.
I missed another one. I'm not asking on the other one. That was my fault. This
Representative has a problem here.
You can have both of them.
Representative Dahlin makes a motion to suspend the rules so Representative Clem can vote on Senate Bill 800A.
Can I ask a question?
Question?
If I decide not to, then it doesn't get to it, or do we all have to vote?
We don't have to vote, Representative. No.
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
To vote on someone has to stay in the building or could still do it from the outside.
You have to stay in the building, I'm afraid.
No.
Although I'm not sure.
That's
actually
the problem with the first bill that I'm not asking are exactly on the premises.
Representative Clem, it's been so moved and passed that you may vote on Senate Bill 800A. How would you like to vote?
Aye.
Representative Clem votes
I'm
aye.
I'm going to switch your vote.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Olson.
Just a comment for the good of order. Mr. Chair, Friday's agenda, Senate Bill 755A, we're going to take it off that agenda, just reschedule it for Wednesday, May 23rd. It's just a scheduling issue. So we have meetings set right now for with agendas issued on Friday. We'll be issuing a revised agenda. And then on Monday, with another one in the works for Wednesday.
Yeah, members, again, as I mentioned at the start of the hearing, the meeting today, that we're aiming to not meet next Friday, week from Friday if possible, the Friday before Memorial Day. It might be necessary for us to make sure we get our bills done to use one of our Tuesdays or Thursday options, and I'll talk with you about any scheduling conflicts you might have on those days as we get closer, just to give you a heads up on that. Very good. You set?
I'd like that.
Very good. Thanks, members. We are adjourned.
How about that?
I can't believe it.
Wow.